something. Oh, it is on. Hello. Good evening. Thank you for coming.
Hello, Victoria Schwab. We are so glad to have you here, finally. Hallo, alle, die Sie gekommen sind. Ich freue mich sehr, dass es so voll geworden ist. Wir haben ein paar Jahre lang versucht, Victoria Schwab nach Stuttgart zu holen von den Dragon Days. Jetzt hat es endlich geklappt. Zwei, drei, ja.
Hey!
Zwei, drei organisatorische Dinge ganz schnell vorab, bevor wir loslegen. Es wird gleich eine Begrüßung geben von der Stadtbibliothek, bei der wir hier zu Gast sind. Keine Sorge, es wird nachher signiert. Wir werden uns ein bisschen beeilen. Sie haben alle Bücher mitgebracht. Da gibt es nachher ein paar Regeln, das sage ich Ihnen, damit das möglichst schnell geht. Sie sehen ja, wie viele Sie sind und wie nah der Sonnenaufgang schon wieder ist dann morgen früh. Das ist das. Das andere ist dann nachher, können wir den Abend ganz auf Englisch machen? Verstehen Sie das alles? Einige nicken, ja, ja. Aber die anderen, auf die kommt es mir jetzt an. Mag jemand die Hand heben, der sagt, ihm, ihr liegt an einer Übersetzung. Sehe ich eine Hand. Dann machen wir das auf Englisch. Sie sind aber eingeladen, dann reinzurufen. Ich weiß nicht, ob alle von Ihnen das Buch schon gelesen haben, aber einige vielleicht ja nicht. Und das wird dann die erste Frage. Hello, Victoria, again.
Hello.
Probably everyone in the room has already read Bury My Bones. But if or if not, it is an amazing thing that you finally come around to vampires. Didn't anyone tell you vampires have been done to death? Weren't you afraid? Didn't they tell you don't do it? Why did you pick vampires?
I mean, nobody said don't do it. I have always loved vampires. I have always found them incredibly attractive and repulsive. They are the intersection between horror and romance. The only reason I didn't write vampires sooner was because when I was first getting into publishing was exactly when Twilight came out. And at the time, because Twilight was so big, one, there was no space for vampires, but also the version of vampires that we were being presented with at that time was incredibly straight and incredibly sanitized. And I appreciate Twilight. I consumed Twilight, but I didn't see myself in Twilight. That wasn't the kind of stories I wanted to tell. I wanted to write a love letter to Anne Rice. I wanted to look at Gothic Romanticism, a place where vampires were more than human, not less than human, and where they truly embodied the defiance of gender norms, of sexuality, binaries, of all of those simple things. To me, vampires represented absolute freedom and hunger and rage and fear. And so it was about finding the right story to write them. It wasn't about never do it. It was about wanting to do it on my terms and in my time. And so I waited until my platform was high enough, until the wake of The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue. And then my publisher was like, what's next? And I was like, I have a new standalone historical fantasy for you. And they're like, ooh, say more. And I was like, toxic lesbian vampires. And to the publisher's credit, they said, yes. But my decision to write vampires is a reckoning with my relationship to publishing, because I didn't just want to write vampires. I wanted to write queer vampires. I wanted to write lesbian vampires. And those I was dissuaded from. I wasn't dissuaded from writing the vampires. I was dissuaded from writing the lesbians, right? Specifically because I wanted to write lesbian villains. And it was like, oh, don't do that. Because if you have a villain and they're a lesbian, then what are you saying about lesbians? Are you saying that they're all villains? Someone's going to conflate these things. And I said, fine. All of the characters are lesbians. not just the villain. But no, what I really wanted to do was I wanted to write queer characters that got to exist in genre. Because for so long, when you have queer characters as a queer human, there was this sense that you had to be mining their trauma. A queer character only got to be the main character if their queerness was the story, if their coming out was the story. And what happens then is you're saying that queer characters, and by extension queer people, aren't afforded the same degrees of nuance and complexity as their straight counterparts. I want to have the freedom to be the hero and the villain in the story. So vampires was something I was never afraid to write, but lesbian vampire villains was something that I had to wait until I had kind of the narrative clout and the power to be able to write and know that it would receive the publishing support.
I think the one of the most attractive things of that book is, well, for me as a reader, not lesbian or not lesbian or whatever, but it is that you said all our lesbians, but all our villains too.
Yeah.
There's not one really impraisable character in there where you can say, oh, she's all good.
No.
Because that is what you're telling then.
Yeah.
Once being a vampire and once deciding for that interesting thing after that era of embraceable, lovable vampires of those super cool guys.
Yeah.
You have people that start out as nice people and then become rotten.
Yeah.
And this is very shocking sometimes in that book. That is very interesting how far you are pushing that and how thin the ice is the reader is walking on.
Yeah.
Weren't you afraid while you were writing that you are shocking your readers too much, that it is too strange a book?
No. I mean, yes and no, right?
Behold the villain.
This is the thing. Maybe it's just a reflection of who I wanted to see on page, who I wanted to read about. But yes, the three main characters at the center of the book are women. And that is extremely important because classically women were taught not to be hungry, not to be cruel, not to be sharp, not to be ambitious, not to be carnal, not to be villains, right? You're right, the three women are all messy. They're meant to be messy. We are allowed to be messy. This is a book about hunger, the hunger to be seen, the hunger to be loved, the hunger to take up space in a world that tries to make you small, and the hunger not only for what you need, but also what you want. And as women and as a queer woman, we are never taught to get what we need, let alone what we want. So yeah, I was never afraid of that. And I'll tell you why, because I knew that readers were going to hate them because they were women. And I knew this because of a character named Delilah Bard. So I wrote a series called Shades of Magic. And in it, I have a character named Lila Bard, my favorite character. Okay? An aspirational character for me, because Lila Bard takes what she wants. Lila Bard is built out of every classic male anti-hero trope. Everything that readers loved when a man was doing it. Oh, he's a little ambitious and he's selfish and sometimes he stabs people, but like, he's so fun. Like, they love them. I literally spent years studying what people loved in a classic male anti-hero. So I wrote one, and then to see what happened, I changed the pronouns. I coded Lila Bard as a classic male antihero, and then I made her a woman. And she is the only character I get hate mail for. She is the only character, there are characters of mine that readers dislike. She is the only one where readers will reach out to me and they will say she should have died as penance for the things that she did. I was like, one, way to guarantee I never kill her. But also, I knew that people were going to judge my characters by virtue of the fact they were women. Once I knew that I couldn't win that, once I knew that like that level of vitriol was going to be targeted at them because I wasn't coding them as male antiheroes or as male villains, I felt free. I was like, oh, you're going to hate them? Fine. I'm going to give you a reason. Right? Because I was searching for a catharsis as a writer and as a reader. I wanted to see Villanelle from Killing Eve. I wanted Lestat, but make it a hot woman, right? Like, I wanted to feel the way I felt at a Florence Welch, Florence and the Machine concert, where I felt like this woman in front of me was larger than life, intoxicating and a little bit frightening because I felt drawn into that pull. I wanted all of that. And I got really tired of making myself and my own desire small to try to fit into the world. So I think all those things that could have frightened me, I chose to embrace them. I knew that I did not want to tell this story in half measures. If I was going to tell it, I was going to let these three women be and become as messy as I wanted them to and as they wanted to.
So now you all know what you have to do when you want a V.E. Schwab character to survive a possible sequel. Write hate mail about that character.
Please don't do that. Please
write
don't do that.
Hate mail.
Please don't
so
do that.
So you keep your favorites alive.
I have decided in advance of all of my books who dies. So it will not work. It will not work. You can try, though.
She's saying that now. Test her out. Okay. Now, Victoria, no two of your standalone books and no two of your series are quite alike.
No.
But they all have at the core a fantastic element, something which we do not find in the world as we know it,
yes.
Or at least it's different on the surface. And there are snotty people who say, okay, yeah, okay, this is fantasy, this is literature that is more or less a simple drug for imbecile people to flee, to escape reality because they are not grown up enough.
Is that what they say?
And that is what they say. And then there are other people who say, what is wrong about fleeing from reality?
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it seems that fantasy has quite shockingly predicted that there are always forces of evil and forces of darkness that are ready and able to overtake civilization, to eat it all away. Where do you stand on that discussion?
I mean, I would say that every piece of fiction is fantasy, right? Every piece of fiction is an escape. Even if you're reading realism, you're escaping into somebody else's life. You might not be escaping into somebody else's world, but you're escaping into a different version of the world. I obviously fall on the line that all storytelling is valid. I think that I understand the desire for escape, but fantasy is so often a mirror as well as a doorway. Fantasy is so often a place wherein we get to see ourselves, but better, but different, but stronger, but stranger. Mirrors are not more or less valid than doorways. Both of them serve a purpose. There are times in our life where we need to escape. There are times in our life when we need to see ourselves. There are times in our life where we think we need one and we actually want the other. Fantasy exists in so many iterations and so many forms, and I'm always amazed when people will tell me two things, sentences back to back. I don't read fantasy. The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue is my favorite book. And I'm like, they cannot both be true. And they're like, well, Addie is not really fantasy. And I'm like, how is it not really fantasy? And they're like, well, you know, it's about a person. I say it's about a person who has a deal with the devil over 300 years. I think that's fantasy. But they're like, well, it doesn't have dragons. It doesn't have witches. It doesn't have, you know, swords and alternate worlds. And I said, fantasy is all of those things and, not all of those things but. Or. The thing about fantasy is that it can represent such a broad spectrum in terms of the departure from reality. I often point out that, like, you have Tolkien, you have Lord of the Rings. That is, if I have 2 feet on the ground right here in reality in this room, Tolkien's at the back wall. I can get there, and I have to walk a long way. I have to leave where I am to get to Lord of the Rings, to get to Middle-earth, to get to Mordor. I will never find Mordor in our world here where I am. And then we have Lewis, who says, somewhere in your house is a door you haven't found. And Lewis is where the photographer is, right? Closer, closer, but I still have to get there. And then once I get there, I'm not here. I want to write fantasy that keeps 1 foot here at all times. Because what that does is, instead of saying in order to believe in magic and monsters and whimsy and wonder, you have to leave our world because it's over there, it says those things can be right here with us. It's about inviting magic in to our world, to our places, to our spaces. That doesn't make it not fantasy. It allows fantasy to graze reality in a way that makes it even more believable. I want our world to be stranger and more wondrous and more magical. I want to believe that that can happen. And all I need to do, I don't actually have to make any of you believe in it. All I have to do is sow the smallest seed of doubt that it isn't real. And the way that that works is Vicious, one of my favorite examples. Vicious, for those who don't know, is a book about two pre-med students, pre-medical students, who discover that near-death experiences are the key to developing superpowers, okay? They then set out to manufacture their own superpowers using their own death and resurrection. It goes horribly wrong. Imagine if imagine if Professor X and Magneto had a really toxic bromance, okay? That's what it is. But I wanted to stay one foot here. And so what I did was I took medical science and I just nudged it. Right? We know that adrenal reactions can be extreme. We have heard stories of a woman lifting a car off their baby, of this momentary, incredible power that can come from stress and trauma. And all I said was, well, what if it stayed? What if you could create a permanent adrenal shift instead of a temporary one? I tried to keep it as medically grounded as possible, but I was still writing fantasy. But the thing is, I once got a letter from somebody, not hate mail, very exciting, at like 4 a.m. from a man who was like, hey, I just need to know for sure. There's no documented cases of this happening, right? And I'm like, there's no documented cases of somebody achieving superpowers through near-death experiences. No, but the fact he had to ask meant that a tiny seed of doubt had wormed its way into his mind, and he was awake at 4 a.m. being like, I cannot find this on Google. And to me, as a fantasy writer, that's what excites me. It is easy to create escapism in a second world. It is easy to create an escapism when all you need is the pages of a book. It is far harder to bring fantasy into our world and still make you believe that it could be real.
You are such a friendly person. I would have answered, I could tell you, but then I would have to kill you. Keep him really awake.
It's delightful to me that you wonder just enough. Because obviously he was 99% sure, but that's all I need is 1% of not sure. And I think that's what I'm saying, is that fantasy can be all the way to the back wall. But we forget that fantasy can also be right here with 2 feet on the ground. And that, to me, is the most intoxicating kind of fantasy. Weirdly, it's the fantasy that allows people to think they don't like fantasy, but they like this. And then I get to break it to them ever so gently that this is fantasy, too.
Now, crime writing, thrillers, have the image of being even more grounded in reality than fantasy. And one of your colleagues has written a How to Write book, a guide, that is called Telling Lies for Fun and Profit.
Yes.
Which is the writer's job. But you, as a strong and proud fantasy writer, could, for a long time, I think, have the feeling that you have broken free of shackles, of chains. You can do more things than a realistic writer can do. And now suddenly, in reality, we make a political experience that lies are constructing an alternate reality in the political sphere or in the sphere of the internet. Wherever we go in the social networks, there are lies all around us. All the time there is constructed alternate reality, what fantasy used to do. How does this enrage you or taint your experience or make you say, I told you so? Or what happens when lies are all around us?
I mean, it's not exactly an easy question, is it? It's difficult. It's difficult. Here's what I'll say. Fantasy and science fiction have for a very long time been the first realm of rebellion in writing, because it's a place where we can, at a safe remove, and I say safe in terms of like from persecution in the real world, explore these exact themes. I mean, there is a city, there are several cities in my country right now going through something very like The Handmaid's Tale. And it is really interesting that I'm watching the comment section on TikTok say, remember Chicago never fell. Remember that even in these predictive fantasies and science fictions, there was the push. There was the fight back. Sometimes we have to draw our examples from fantasy to give us strength in reality. Sometimes we have the escape. And that's why I say sometimes it's a door, sometimes it's a mirror, sometimes it's a shield and a sword. Fantasy is where we go to feel safe when reality doesn't make it so. Fantasy is where we go to hope when reality doesn't make it so. Fantasy is also where we go to remind ourselves it's all fantasy. You say that there's lies happening in reality right now being pretending to be truth. They've always been. They've always been. Reality has always been subjective. Truth has always been subjective. Who's reality, right? Because for many, many years in the States, certain people got to feel safe, but certain people never did, right? It's important to remember that a lot of the things that we're seeing right now, they were already there. They're just not pretending anymore. They're not pretending to be truthful. They're not pretending to be honest. I think that this is where we remember that fiction is an empathy engine. Whether it's fantasy or realism, fiction is where often many readers will discover people unlike them for the first time. Fiction is where we invite people in, not where we kick people out. Fiction is where we invite people in to learn, to see themselves in different positions. You know, I had a really interesting interaction with an interviewer recently with a man who had read Bury Our Bones. And he said, you know, it was weird. You just didn't treat people like me very nicely. And I was like, what do you mean? And he was like, it's just like we weren't even really part of the story. And then when we were part of the story, we were basically just like an object. We weren't even the main character. And I was like, you got it. I was like, you got it. How did that feel? Like, right? This is the thing. Fiction is where we have the luxury to shift the lens. We cannot control in reality who gets the microphone. In fiction, we do. And sometimes, like, I had a really honest conversation with that man. Because he had truly never read a book where he wasn't the hero or the villain. He had never read a book where he did not matter to the narrative. And I said to him, I spent the first 25 years of my life reading only those books. It's really unfortunate, isn't it, to not see yourself as the subject in the story. And that's the thing, is these are places where those conversations can happen, because in his real life, he's not going to experience that. In his real life, he is the default model in America. He moves through the world. He will never feel fear by virtue of his presentation. The reason the women in my book are vampires is because it was the only way I could think to absolve them of fear. Because the fact is that moving through this world in certain bodies puts you in peril. By virtue of your shape, your gender, your sexuality, your creed, your ethnicity, it puts you in danger. I walk into the world and I am inherently prey. I walk into a predatory world and I feel unsafe in it. And so when I was looking at how to give my women the freedom that they sought, I realized what I could do would be turn them into the predator. Give them, for the very first time in their life, the ability to move through the world without being inherently afraid that something bad would happen to them because they were now the bad thing. And that's an incredibly liberating force. And I said to that interviewer, I said, I'm a runner. I can't go running at night. He goes, why? He genuinely had never thought of this. He was like, why can't you go running at night? I said, I have to do math here. There is a 90% chance I'm safe. And a 10% chance that I won't be. And I have to decide which way I want to lean that day.
I always have to weigh that. If I go out into the world at night, I go for a run and something bad happens to me, they'll say, well, she shouldn't have been out there at night. And you have to weigh that. That is the world we live in. And so fiction is the place where we get to turn it. We don't solve all the problems in fiction. We don't make the world suddenly painless. There would be no story. Conflict creates narrative. But it is a place where we get to change who the main character is and how they live.
Now, this has been happening for a few decades,
slowly.
The change of perspectives, the empowerment of other voices, get the female perspective into fiction, into genre fiction, get queer perspectives in, get the black perspective in, and so on and so forth. In the real world again, in many areas where the Americans at least thought, we have achieved this, we can never go back, now there's a rollback in record time.
Yes.
Then there is not only erased what happened in the last few decades, in the two or three last, but there's erased something that happened even earlier, you know. Now there have been no black soldiers in the Second World War.
Yeah. Now there's no slavery. Didn't you hear?
Now there's no slavery.
Now there's no evidence. They are rolling back in American museums. Yeah. They are erasing the visual evidence of slavery. They are changing textbooks. They are rolling. It's the recoil, right? It's going back further and further and further. I'm banned. My books are banned all over the place. The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue is banned for two separate reasons. One, a bisexual. Two, the devil, right? God forbid we have both. In the same book, I joke, but it's grim. It's grim. It is all the more reason that things like this are important. It is all the more reason because this is a frontier that is harder for them to push back.
But can it reach publishing, or is it already reaching publishing?
But it can't reach publishing without the consent of the reader. Mm. This is the thing. Publishing is a business, not an ethical one. It is a business. And it cannot make concessions like that unless readers let it. This is why it is important. You vote with your dollar, we say in the States. Every choice you make, everything you buy, every story you pay money for, and every story that you pirate. Because if you decide to not pay money for the story, then it gets easier to erase the story in the first place. And we've seen this happen in every direction. The reason that Bury Our Bones was allowed to exist as a book with mainstream publisher support in the way that it did is because I transactionally used the success of The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue, which is a queer book, but a quiet queer book, right? Like, some straight people, blink and you miss it. Oh my God, were there ever gay people in this book? Blink and You Miss It is a quiet queer book, and I knew that I was going to translate the financial success of that book into the support for Bones. There are hundreds of queer books that haven't received that support because publishing uses monetary markers. So what happens is I knew a few things. I knew that I could translate the success of Addie into publishing support for Bones. I knew then that Bones would succeed. I knew that when Bones succeeded, the data of its success could be used to elevate more queer stories. Because suddenly, the authors and the agents trying to sell more queer stories and more queer fantasy, more queer genre specifically, where we get to be something besides just one aspect of our identity, where we get to be heroes and villains and have monsters and slay monsters and be monsters, all these things, I knew that having the metric data of the audience's approval to show there is a market for it would then allow the next author to get more support. And so it all comes down to the readers. If the readers pay for the books that have this kind of visibility, the books with this visibility will continue to be published. If readers stop, it's one of the things I have a concern with romantasy in America. And I respect it as a genre. My issue with it is that on the whole, the romanticies given the most support are pretty straight. They're pretty classic. Big, strong man, teeny, tiny girl. He growls and breaks down walls, teeny, tiny girl, right? There's really specific, pretty classic gender dynamics at work in the vast majority of huge romanticy novels. And the only issue I have with that is That is the readership then saying, this is what we want. And publishing is a reactive engine, not an active engine. So it hears it and it says 10 more of those and only those, because those are what's selling. So it's like a very clear cycle between what gets bought, what gets sold. Publishing is an incredibly reactive industry. It will give you whatever it thinks you want based on what you have bought.
But isn't a certain kind of romanticism even worse than you painted it? Because it is the big, strong guy and the teeny tiny woman, and the teeny tiny woman being so satisfied that this is a mistreater, that is someone who hurts her, because then really interested in her. And this is the new toxic trope.
No,
I think
here's
this
the
is
thing.
Going a bit further, isn't
the
it?
I'm not going to name the book, but to this day, my entire life, I'm 38. I have been on this earth for 38.2 years. I have returned one book to the bookstore. I bought a book, read it, got so mad at it that I went to the bookstore and said, I'm so sorry, someone gave this to me as a gift and I already had a copy. And I returned it because I was that mad because it did this. It projected, especially in young adult, which has a lower age threshold readership of about 12 and then an upper age of 95. It had a young male love interest who was physically and psychologically abusive to the female protagonist, and it was being couched as an ideal romance. Now, I write super problematic people all the time. The difference is I call a spade a spade. I'm like, Luke, you can like him in The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue. We're not going to call him a healthy boyfriend, right? The devil is a petulant adult toddler who is used to getting his way, and we can like it, but we're not going to be like, I wish I had a boyfriend who treated me the way Luke treats Addie by essentially imprisoning her in a jail of one for 300 years. The problem is when it is portrayed as an ideal romance, when it is portrayed as an ideal dynamic, because then you're right. Then what are we saying? Oh, he could kill me at any moment, but it's okay. He loves me more. That is the dynamic that was in the book I returned, by the way. I'm not speaking about any other book except that one. But I pay attention to these things. I pay attention to the fact that, like, you're telling, when you buy those books, you're telling the publisher, give me more of exactly this. Publishing doesn't have a whole lot of imagination. It looks at, like, ABC. You said you liked ABC. Here's 100 more ABC. And it's one of the issues, I think, with where we're at right now in how we talk about books that we like, how we reduce them to a subgenre, to a sub and a sub and a sub and a sub, and we make it more and more specific, because where's the discovery? If you know exactly what you like to read at all times, how will you discover something new? So I have concerns about the industry because I have seen over the last 15 years how reactive it is to the buying trend.
So you all probably know a bit or a lot about Victoria Schwab, but there's one thing you probably do not know about her. She is a bit of a clairvoyant. She's psychic. She knows things she shouldn't know by law, by the laws of nature. She told me before this evening that you have brought questions. So prove her right. I will come with a microphone to you.
Oh, I was like, how am I clairvoyant? I want to know. If I were clairvoyant, I would already know.
Ich komme mit dem Mikrofon, wenn Sie Ihre Hand kräftig... Okay, da hinten, ja, habe ich auch gesehen. Einfach nochmal danach kräftig die Hand hoch.
Hallo.
Hi.
I have a question.
Yes.
If you could haunt some of your characters from all books as a ghost,
yes,
who would it be and how would you annoy them the most?
I mean, you know, my immediate temptation is to say Kelmarech from A Darker Shade of Magic because I just feel like it would bother him more than it would bother anyone else. I think I would really like to haunt Eli from Vicious, because I think, again, it would really mess with his head because he's so religious that I feel like it probably would drive him a bit mad. I think I would I think it would, yeah. Why is it's always the boys. Yeah, I think I would have the most fun haunting both Kel and Eli. Everyone else, I think, would be pretty unbothered. Like, everyone else that I write is pretty good at rolling with it, you know? They would be just like, oh, ghosts, and move on with their life. But I think Kel, if you were just like, I would just be knocking stuff off tables around him like a cat, and I think it would really start to distress him. Yeah.
So, jetzt mal hier drüben irgendwo. Ja, genau da.
Hi.
Hi.
You've mentioned before that you put parts of yourself in the different characters that you write, and I wanted to know if you had an experience that stood out in the way of it really healed a part of yourself to write a certain character.
Oh, that's great. I have a couple. Henry from The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue is the most autobiographical character I've ever written. He is exactly who I would have been if I had not found writing when I did. Our paths diverge at age 19. That is when I wrote my first book, and he did not. But he is so close to my heart because I feel like he's who I would have become. I struggled to get to know him when I was first writing him, and so I would give him more and more of myself, more of my anxiety, more of my depression, more of my struggles, until it just felt like I had a mirror right there in the book. It made it really scary when it was time for the book to come out because I think I take it most personally if people don't like him. Most people like him, so it's okay. But like, if you don't like him, please don't tell me. I will take it very personally. In terms of catharsis, though, definitely, I was going to say Sabine because it was so cathartic to just be unapologetic. The three women in Bones, Alice, Charlotte, Sabine, they represent the three parts of my own kind of coming out journey. Alice, 18, has no idea who she is or who she wants to be. Charlotte knows who she is but is afraid of not being loved. And Sabine knows who she is and is unapologetic. Sabine was the most cathartic to write, except there's a storyline in Bones, no spoilers, don't worry, between Charlotte and a character named Jocelyn. Essentially, Charlotte at 16 is madly in love with her best friend named Jocelyn. Jocelyn is not brave enough to love her back. It haunts Jocelyn all of Jocelyn's life. Charlotte runs into her when Jocelyn is in her 80s and essentially thinks that Charlotte is a ghost, and we learn that Jocelyn has been haunted her whole life by this mistake. I fell in love with a girl when I was 16, and she wasn't brave enough to love me back, and I never really got the kind of closure that Lottie gets from Jocelyn, and so I think the writing of that scene, it's the only scene in the book that makes me cry. Only one. So I think that was probably the most necessarily cathartic for me of all the characters that I've written.
So, next question.
Okay. Next question. Be brave.
Yeah.
Okay. You're all so brave.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
If you could make write a scene where you could make two characters you wrote but from different books meet each other, who would those characters be in which setting and scene would that play out?
I can't tell you because I haven't written it down yet, but I have one coming that I think will make people very happy. Two characters from two different books. I will say there is a cameo in Bury Our Bones for Addie LaRue. If you look among the list of Charlotte's one-night lovers, you'll find it. But yeah, the one that I'm most excited by, I haven't written down yet. Sorry. I could have made up an answer, but that's more fun to tell you the truth. Next question. Over here. Yep, yep. Guys, this side, right here. I was gonna say, this side's acting pretty brave.
Okay. I hope it's audible. Yes, it's audible.
Yes, of course.
Sometimes characters feel like they have a life of their own, even when an author writes them.
Yeah.
Is there anything in your books where a character surprised you and you didn't quite see it coming?
So I work so hard to make my characters feel like real people. And by that, I mean when you put down the book at the end, I don't want you to believe they stop existing. So I treat them like real people. They don't tend to surprise me in a good way because I like to play God. So when I'm writing a book, by the time I sit down to actually draft the book, I have spent roughly a year learning every aspect of the story and figuring out exactly how I want to tell it. So I spend about a year building a skeleton for the book that will have every single scene, every single plot beat for the character. So by the time I sit down to actually write it, I should know how every character is going to act. I kind of run them through simulations. So like I will take a character, I will think I understand them, and to be sure, I'll drop them into the context of a scene, almost like a rat in a maze, and watch how they move through it. Lila Bard, easy example, she's going to stab someone. Like, you drop her into a scene, someone is getting knifed by the end of the scene. I can, like, guarantee it. It might be in Kel's defense, it might be in her own interest. Like, someone's getting axed. But I need to know so that I know how my characters react to stimuli. So that's to say, no, they don't surprise me, because if they do, it's a bug, not a feature. If they do, I have messed up somewhere that I don't understand them well enough. For me, the act of writing the story down is an act of execution of an idea. Like I have a model, I have all of the framework, the scaffolding, and then I'm building it. But I will say, I want them to live and breathe and feel real. I want you to believe when you finish the book that their story continues and you're simply not allowed to follow anymore. It's like the guiding force for me when I'm writing. This side's so brave. Look at all the hands go up. There's now, not, there were more hands last time, but.
Hi.
Hi.
There was a controversy on TikTok that a couple of authors were going to expose another author for using AI to write their book.
Yeah.
I was wondering, what are your thoughts on authors using AI and ChatGPT to write their books or come up with ideas for it?
I mean, it's not going to be a positive answer for me here. This is what I literally kill myself doing. Every book I've written has nearly been the death of me, psychically. A book is currently trying to kill me. I know it seems like I'm sitting up here, but Victorious is like actively trying to end my life right now. It's soulless. You can use a prompt. ChatGPT is not a prompt. You can find prompts all in the world. You can find prompts from many, many sources. It's not about telling a perfect story. It's about telling your story. It's about telling the story that only you, from your perspective, in your voice, can tell. There are only 10 stories out there, you guys. If I gave a pitch, if I gave a prompt to everyone in this room, same prompt, same elevator pitch, two sentences, I would get 250 different stories. The story isn't the thing, it's your voice. It's your reason for telling it. You're carving out what is arguably the most important part, which is the work. It's through the labor of the work that we find our reason for telling stories. That's the heartbeat. It's the same way that AI can make a work of art. It's not art. It's not a heartbeat. It's components. It's an automaton, right? It can be clever. It can be visually interesting. It doesn't have a soul.
Hi.
Hi.
I love how in Bones, the type of people that they were before they got turned determines the kind of traits that get amplified when they get vampirized.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, what kind of vampire would Caddy have been?
Okay, so Caddy, for those who don't know, is Alice's sister. here I am, like, I can't tell you. I'm actually writing that for the paperback. I'm writing an alt story about what would have happened if it had been Caddy turned instead of Alice. Also, this is right here is the first time that I have ever said that. So if you could please not take to the internet, because I don't want to get in trouble. but I'm deeply curious about this because who we are defines so much about who we become. Because that's all it is. Like a vampirism, it's a transaction. It's just a volume button. It's just a volume button. It just amplifies. It makes the thing that you already were louder. Like, Sabine is a great example. Sabine was never going to have a long, happy life as a human. She was going to get burned as a witch, right? Like, Sabine was going to murder someone and get torched. Her becoming a vampire was the happy ending for Sabine, right? It wasn't going to go. Like, she fantasizes about murdering everyone in her life before she becomes a vampire. So, like, she's just living her best, right? So, being a vampire, great for Sabine. Being a vampire, bad for Alice, right? Right now. Being a vampire, bad for Alice as we it's early days, but it's bad for Alice, right? And so I think a lot about Caddy, because Caddy is such an opposite to Alice in every way. I wonder if it will go well for her. I guess we'll have to wait and see. I haven't written it down yet. This is the problem. I don't know either. We're going to figure it out together. But I am really curious about that. And that's the thing. I want it to live in that potential of, like, any character you meet. You're like, well, what if? What if I turned this one dial up? Dun, dun, dun. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering... I mean, you're an author, so yes. Of course you write. But
I try.
I assume you also read a lot.
I do.
And I was wondering if you ever read a book where you think, damn, that's a good idea, but I could have done it better.
I love that until you finished the question, I wasn't sure which way it was going to go. Yes, of course. There have been several times where I'm like, that idea, gorgeous. That execution, but that's the thing, right? Is like, I learn from everything I read. I read between 100 and 150 books a year. If you had asked me a month ago, I would have said it would have been 150 this year, but I have been in a divot because of Victorious being so precarious, so it's probably going to be about 130. I read everything from poetry and memoir and nonfiction and historical and fantasy and sci-fi and poetry and children's and so on. I love... maybe 5 books a year. I like maybe 15. The rest I learn from. I'm a very particular reader, but we learn from what works and what doesn't if we know how to antagonize it, if we know how to intellectualize it and stop and say, the same way you would if you're watching a movie or a TV show and you're like, something about this scene just hits. Why? Like, I don't know how many of you have seen Sinners. Okay. If you have not, congratulations, it's spooky season. Please go watch Sinners. There is a scene in Sinners that will live rent-free in the rest of my mind involving the building burning down. And that scene hits so hard that I think about it and I want to write scenes that make me feel like that, right? So we learn from what works. And then sometimes when I'm like, this idea was great, why am I not vibing with it? I stop and I antagonize that question and I figure out the why. So yeah, I read widely. Every now and then I think, oh, that idea was wasted on them. But at the same time, I have more ideas than I will ever get to write in my life. And so I am pretty good at keeping my eyes on my own paper. I also think it's important to like remember, as a fantasy author, I don't get ideas for stories from other fantasy novels. Like, I appreciate them. I get story ideas from a random song or a memoir. If any of you are writers, raise your hand if you write. Great. I feel like it's twice that many people, but some of you won't raise your hand because you don't consider it real in some way. But read memoir. Memoir, to me, is the single greatest character study. You have a person according to themselves with their highlights and their lowlights and their voice. It is one of the best things you can do to get a grasp of how to write a person as a person. But yeah, I assess everything that I read. Most of the time, it's because I want the voice to be different. I also just really, I'm in a stage of my life where I want everything to be weird. And not just that, like nothing will piss me off more than somebody pulling their punches. Like if a story is weird and they don't lean in, they don't just go with their whole heart to the weird place, they pull back. Maybe they thought, oh, 80% in. They were like, oh, it's not commercial enough. Or like, oh, I won't sell it. I get pissed because I'm like, you took me on this journey. I don't care if you burn it down, but like commit to the thing that you're doing. Be weird.
Dun, dun, dun. Okay, so it's been established. You can ask anything.
Yes.
Give us. Okay.
There's no rules until I decide there are. Hi.
So basically, all of your like characters are really, really fun to experience.
Yeah.
Which like character did you have the most fun writing and why?
Sabine. Sabine, because again, Sabine is made of three people. Sabine is made of Lestat, Villanelle, and Florence Welch. She is a delight. She is horrifying, right? But she is vibing. Like, there's no self-loathing in Sabine. Sabine is pure... Is it id? I'd always get the id and the ego mixed up. She's pure id. Sabine is a really interesting one to write because she has almost no internal monologue. She doesn't care. Like, there's a scene in which Charlotte, brand new baby vampire Charlotte, is like, what does it all mean? Like, what are we taking from them? Are we just taking blood? Are we taking their soul? Are we taking part of their life? Like, what does it mean? And Sabine's like, I don't care. Like, Sabine's like, it has genuinely not occurred to her in 150 years to ask that question. She is the opposite of introspective. She's just like, I'm out here. I'm living my life. It's fun. I kill because I like it. Oh, ladies taste better. I guess I'll just kill them. Like, she's out here vibing in a way that I found so much fun to write, because when you take away this like social imperative to be good, to be soft, to be warm, to be accommodating, and you just let somebody like Sabine act the way she would in a world without patriarchy, delightful. I recommend it. Just make a person like that. Just create one, because while I was writing her, I write chronologically. So you read the book in narrative order, wherein we jump from this character and then into a flashback and et cetera, but that's not how I write it. I write all three women in their entirety, in their chronological order. So it's three novellas in a trench coat for me, right? I sit down and I spend 6 months writing Sabine from the moment we meet her when she's 10 years old to the moment we leave her on meeting Charlotte. And for those 6 months, I am just having an absolute blast. So, yeah, I found, like, she was the most fun for me to write. There are a lot of characters that people find fun to read, and I find agonizing to write because they're just really, like, Holland in Shades of Magic, where there's, like, a high wire act. I find Rye really difficult for that same reason, because he's, like, such an extrovert and I'm not. I find Charlotte the hardest to write in this book, because she's so empathetic, but also because she pisses me off. I had an ex that was too much like Charlotte, okay? Someone who could never do a bad thing because they were so convinced they weren't a bad person, even as they were doing bad things, right? So sometimes characters are really hard for me, but really fun for the reader, but Sabine was just really fun for me. I will often tell people, I did when Bowens first came out, like, I wrote 24 books for everybody. This one's for me. I needed Bury Our Bones. I needed it. I needed to have the permission to write these women. I've lost him. There he is.
Hi.
Hi.
Since you mentioned taking inspiration from songs and Florence Welch, I wanted to ask, did you have any songs from her in mind when writing these characters?
King and Free were the two that... That's just because they came out right when I was writing this. They're part of, like, the official soundtrack. I have an official soundtrack online that's broken down by woman. So Alice has a completely different soundtrack to Charlotte and to Sabine. You can just, like, Google soundtrack, you know, playlist. But yeah, I honestly, I have been with Florence that has been my favorite artist back since My Boy Builds Coffins, like way back. I have yet to find a song of hers that didn't pluck that heartstring for me, like pluck that chord in my chest. But King and Free were the main ones for Sabine, for her.
Hi. Since you said you read so much, are there any tropes that annoy you? For example, when I read a book and I see a third act breakup, I'll immediately close it and not continue reading it.
Yeah. Ooh. There's not in like a trope itself. I think I'm pretty good at like staying away from those books in the first place if I know they're just going to anger me. I think it's really hard to make me buy a love triangle because the vast majority of love triangles are not love triangles. They're an OTP and an obstacle. They're not really love triangles. Like, I feel like Addie, Luke, and Henry is a love triangle, right? There's an obsession triangle there. They need to be like as into each other as they are. Most of the time with love triangles, though, I'm like, I'm like, you both suck. Like, why? I'm supposed to believe you're both this great. I don't really like either one of you. So one, it's kind of like you're setting yourself up for failure as an expectation because now I'm like supposed to believe they're both great. And also then, why is this other person so great that they have these two people? So either they're both great and I'm like, what's your deal though? Or they kind of suck. Most of the time though, it just feels artificial. Most of the time for me, a love triangle reads as an authorial invention and not an organic piece of the story. I am, as you can probably tell, slightly antagonistic towards romance in general. The only reason being, I love it. So often when we have a romantic element in a book, every other relationship gets automatically downgraded. And I've got to tell you what I like even more than a romance, family problems. Siblings, friends, enemies, allies, all of these really cool relationship dynamics that just get automatically downgraded if two people want to kiss. And it bums me out because I want us to have all of it. I want us to have romance and antagonism and enemies. And enemies doesn't have to become enemies to lovers to be an interesting relationship dynamic. I sometimes just want them to be enemies, right? And like, I think so often that we're doing a disservice when we basically are like, oh, but there's a couple. I'm like, well, there's a lot of pairings. They're just not all romantic. So for me, I have to really like everything else that's happening to be down with a romance. I don't like a romance as the sole motivating factor. I like a romance as a reward. Like, I thought we were going to die, but we didn't. So now we can be together.
Hi.
Hi. Where am I looking?
Hi. Hi. I was wondering, because I created my OCs like a year ago,
yeah,
and it took me like 7 months or so to name them. Before that, they were just vibes.
I don't know how you do that.
Yeah. How do you have a process of naming your characters? Do you struggle?
I struggle so much, and I cannot start writing them until they have a name. I can't do it. They're not real. Like, I can't do a placeholder name. I can't do anything. Now, you have to understand about me. I did not have a name for the first 2 weeks of my life. Because my parents wanted to vibe with me. It's true. They were deciding between two or three names. And they were like, how are we supposed to name the tiny human? We don't know her. And I'm so grateful that they waited. I had a blank space on my birth certificate. They went back to the hospital and filled it in when they were ready, right? Because I am a Victoria. I am not a Samantha, which is what the other name was. Samantha's a great name, not me. Right? And so I'm kind of the same with my characters. I'll start to like vibe and get to know them and I'll try on names, but I will not write a single line of their story until they have the name. And once they have the name, it cannot change. I do not care. There are like 4 books with an Alice out this year. I do not care. The very first book that I ever had come out, The Near Witch, has a character named Lexi and a character named Cole. And I found out 3 months before release that another book was coming out on the same day with a Lexi and a Cole. And we were going to print later that week. And they were like, it's okay, you can change yours. And I said, I shall not. I said, I don't care. These characters have been in my mind. This is their name. You don't change a name. The only times characters get to change a name is when they change the name. So I deal with naming conventions a lot in my books in terms of, especially with queer identity, nicknames, self-chosen names, names that do fit and don't fit. Names are important. Like, Lila's name does not fit, and it is part of the story. She makes it fit, but it is so soft compared to who she is. So for me, I'll have nameless characters who are given names by people who care about them, right? Every character in this book has two names. They have a name and a nickname. You know, or in the case of Sabine, Maria Sabine, Charlotte, Lottie, Alice Bones, right? So to me, naming is too important to be taken lightly, but I don't have a system. It's pure vibes. Like, I have to taste it. And this comes from my poetry background, I think, but I need to know how the sounds taste. And I'll, like, test. I'll rewrite the same moment over and over, changing it out the name to see which one tastes right when I say it out loud. These are such good questions, everyone.
Hi.
Hi.
I was going to ask if there are any characters that you feel like your readers kind of unappreciate them.
Yeah.
Like characters that that you personally love, but that kind of get ignored too much by the readers.
I have whole books like that. I have a duology called The Monsters of Verity, which is this savage song and our dark duet. And August and Kate get so much less love. And they are by far, like, I'm so proud of their story. I love it so much. I can always tell when someone hasn't finished our dark duet because they'll still talk to me. It was like my favorite experience writing that duology. I mean, you know, writing it was all horrible. Writing books for me is terrible. I don't like it. I don't know why I'm here. But I'm so proud of them. And nobody ever talks about August and Kate. Like, I don't know why. 30 years from now, I hope people will talk about them because I'm so intensely proud of them. Specifically Kate. Kate was my original angry girl. Like, Kate came before Marcella, came before Sabine, came before Lila. Actually, she came after Lila. Never mind. In my head, she came before Lila. She was my YA version of Lila Bard. She's so angry. She literally opens her section of the book burning down a school chapel because she wants to get it kicked out of the school. I just love her so much. She had metal nails before I had metal nails. I wish Kate got more love. How you can tell an American is uncomfortable with silence. I have to make sound effects in between.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for coming to Stuttgart.
It's my pleasure.
I have a question about you talked about the publishing industry a lot. And I know you did First Kill for Netflix. And I would love to get your opinion on the entertainment industry. You don't have to, no spoilers, but like, I'm just curious about like how, not how it works, but how you as an author and the owner decide what gets given to that industry and what doesn't.
The short answer is you don't get to choose. It's all or nothing. If you decide to sell a project, you are ceding control. And that's one of the hardest things. It's like, so often as consumers of art, we still see TV and film as the highest possible bar. And I do too. I love something and I immediately want it to exist in a visual medium. It's really hard from the authorial side because I have that and I hold that. And I also know when I'm writing a novel, I am in control. At the end of the day, my editor is there to make it better, help me make it better. But if I say someone dies, they die. If I say this sentence is the sentence, is this sentence, I can override anything. There is a phrase in publishing, it's called STET. STET. If you put it in the margins of any editorial note, it essentially says disregard. At the end of the day, it is my name on the cover, it is my words on the page, and I have full control. In TV and film, it is a rule by committee. The moment you sell a project into TV and film, even if you were there as an executive producer, I was an executive producer on my show, it did not mean a single thing. You cede all power because the people who are bankrolling it have a committee. I will never forget, like, so First Kill sold based on my pilot. So I wrote a pilot script based on my short story. The Netflix picked up an entire season of the show based on my pilot. It was a really good pilot. The first episode of that show, which has my name stamped all over it, bears almost no resemblance. So it is still credited to me, and they changed almost every single line. So that was a really hard learning experience because collaboration is a wonderful part of the creative process. I'm sitting up here like freaking out about this art that is being made in real time about like this is collaboration. This is a word and an art, right? An artist and a writer. I love collaboration. I have done scripts. I have done comics. There's a frustration to the collaboration that comes in TV and film though, because at the end of the day, it's not a dialogue. It's a power structure. I advocated as hard as I could for things. And when they didn't like what I was advocating for, it was ignored. And so what I struggled with was not that, but I struggled with the fact my name was still on it. So readers would come to me or viewers would come to me and be like, why did you pick that song in this scene? Or why did you have them say this? As if I had any control. I was sitting there trying so hard not to let them straight wash it. So hard keeping the characters queer. And so it's a struggle. I Addie LaRue is in development right now. We're pretty far along. And one of the reasons is it has taken so long for The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue to get made is because the producers and I are shielding the project. It could have gotten made very quickly and very badly. It could have been a straight-to-streaming thing like 2 years ago. And we held. Because most of the time, you only get to do it one time. And I would rather something take longer and be better. And so I'm so excited for where it is right now. It could die tomorrow. I am what I call a popcorn optimist, which means the moment I can sit in a movie theater with a bucket of popcorn and watch it, it's real. And you will not hear me calling that real until that moment. I have had things canceled at every single step. Projects that never even got announced, that were cast, that were directed, that were written, all of them dead because one day a studio changed its mind on what it wanted that year. So I struggle because I love TV and movies. I am such a consumer of this culture. I want nothing more than to say, I will it into the universe. Here's your show. Here's your movie. And if it were up to me, I would do that every time. If it were up to me, you'd have an anime of Shades of Magic. If it were up to me, we would have a Vicious TV show. If it were up to me, the Addie film would be out. And at the end of the day, I have willed so hard for so many things. I spent 8 months trying to get a Vicious TV show made. 8 months. And they came back and they were like, you know, it's not The Boys. We kind of want it to be more like The Boys. I'm like, it is the exact tonal opposite of my show, right? So that's too much information, but basically I try really, really hard, and now what I do, and what only thing you can do if you decide to embark on TV and film, is try to team up with producers that are as protective of the work as you are. There have been a few times when I would have pushed go on the Addie movie, and I had a producer who was like, we are not ready yet. You will not be happy with who we're able to cast based on this script or et cetera or where we're at. And so I'm so happy we've waited because we're doing really cool things. And again, it might never happen. And that's the thing is at the end of the day, if I write a book, even if a publisher didn't want it, I could put out the book. I could work and then I could say, here's your story. But the amount of work that never materializes into something you all can enjoy is the frustration that I have with TV and film and why I have essentially an 85-15 rule. I have to spend 85% of my time on books and stories I know I can have get made into stories and 15% on everything else. Oh, I've lost my dude.
We are very close to the finishing line.
Oh, no.
And,
or oh, yes, depending on your... Mood.
Victoria has to go back and fight Netflix.
I do.
So she can't stay here all the time in Germany. I have one more question here, and then I think we have time for one more question, and then we'll go to the signing.
Hi.
Hi.
So my favorite character is Victor Vale.
Yes.
While I was reading his story, I always wondered where the inspiration came from for him. marking out words in his textbooks and creating new sentences.
Yeah, Victor Vale does blackout poetry. And here's what I love my job so much. I have no idea. Like, one of the very first scenes I worked on for him, I just gave him that. He had a Sharpie, he was twirling it, and I just thought, there's a destructive force in this young man, and it needs somewhere to go. And I loved the idea that he wasn't just blacking it out. He was making his own story. And that became this guiding force for Victor Vale. I will leave my mark, right? I will not be a sidekick. I will not be a secondary character. I will be the main character, and I will leave my mark on this world. And for him, it's almost meditative. It's a calming thing. And if you think about that sound that a Sharpie makes as it just drags through a line, it's so satisfying. And I just like that, like, it's so artistic, and Victor is, we would not think that way. Like, Victor is so analytical. He's so precise. And it also, it's a little bit of chaos. I don't know if any of you have tried doing blackout poetry, but if you do it and you don't cheat, if you don't, like, go through and kind of mark the words that you want in advance, but if you actually do it going in order and kind of, like, go until you find a word you like and then go until you find and stop, it's hard. But the most magical things come out of it. Every time I've done blackout poetry for Victor Vale, I have essentially dropped in a block of text and made myself try and do it. I never want to start with the sentence that I want him to get to. I start from a place of, like, what can I make that sounds like Victor out of this block of text? But I wish it came from, like, I didn't plan him that way. I just one day started building him. He was my first autobiographical character. Victor Vale, Henry Strauss, Sabine. My eras. they've really gone.
Okay, now is the moment when I make enemies.
Oh no. They're one, like, we're done.
One more last question over here.
Yeah.
But there come another moment when I make even more enemies.
Uh-oh.
And you'll see why the microphone goes to this side.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks so much for letting me have that. I'm a huge fan of your newsletter.
Thank you.
I love reading your thoughts on craft and your writing process, but I can imagine it can be quite difficult to navigate how much to disclose to your readers. And I was wondering, how do you decide on that, and how do you deal with that vulnerability?
So I write a monthly newsletter. It's free. You should all sign up. I put so much work into it every single month. It has my life. It has my work. It has the answer is I put everything I can. I put everything I can. I started in publishing when I was quite young, and publishing is so lonely. I was 19, 20 years old, and like publishing makes you feel like an island. You look around, and everyone is only sharing good news. And if you don't have good news, it just makes you feel like you must be failing. On days when the writing is hard and everyone is only sharing their happy progress reports, you feel like it must be an indictment of your ability as a writer instead of the fact that it's hard. I have always been extremely transparent online for the sole reason of making other readers and writers feel less alone. It is not comfortable to be as honest as I am on the internet, but it is a thing I swore to do at the very, very beginning, 16 years ago. And it's the thing I still do, because I don't ever want anyone to feel as alone as I felt. And the fact is, I am working on my 27th book right now, and it is still so hard. And if you're working on your first book or your fifth book or you're thinking about writing a book, I want you to know that that is not a sign that you are bad at it. It is a sign that this thing that we're doing is hard. That you have to strip all of your armor off to find the vulnerability to write and then somehow put all of that armor back on to be perceived. It's a trick. When this book came out, I felt like I still had one leg trying to get my armor on. I didn't feel like I was ready in any way. So yeah, I'm as honest as I can be. If I leave something out, it's either because I'm legally not allowed to talk about it yet, like with The Ending Race itself, with the thriller where I could not talk about that book until it was revealed, because it's a pseudonym, or it involves my family. There are things I won't talk about because they've asked me not to. So if it's personal and it's not just my story, I check with them. That's why I'll write around things sometimes, like the existential detour from last month, where that wasn't mine. It wasn't only mine. But in general, if I can be honest, I'm honest. And if I can't be, I would rather not talk about it at all than lie. I'll never lie. I'll never tell a lie in the newsletter. I'll simply wait until I can tell the truth. Yeah.
Thank you so very much, Victoria. Could go on and on and on and stay interesting.
Thank you.
Yes. And Hannah Wenzel with her beautiful paintings, and Isabel Schmier, who read the text to us. And thanks to City Library, Stadtbibliothek Stuttgart, who is such a gracious host to us.